So today we're going to continue talking about gravitational waves. So I just want to say a couple things following up our discussion of writing gravitational waves in terms of these two polarizations, H plus and H cross. And then we'll spend most of the class talking about the generation of gravitational waves in the source zone, driving the quadrupole formula, and hopefully get to at least writing down expressions for the energy and angular momentum carried away by gravitational waves. So last time in class I mentioned we wrote down these two polarizations for our gravitational waves. And then we talked about how basically this determines the magnitude of the displacement you get from freely falling particles or test masses or things following geodesics. So if you actually work out what these two different polarizations correspond to, you can imagine you have some circular ring of test masses, and then you have a gravitational wave traveling through the board. So then this H plus will correspond to sort of a squeezing in one direction, and then the other direction. And that would be sort of one period of the gravitational wave passing through the board for this polarization. Of course, this is grossly exaggerated. And then the cross polarization, if we start with a circle, when it's unperturbed, sort of get something that's like that. And then the other direction. And one final thing I wanted to note is that if we consider some rotation phi about the z-axis, where the z-axis is the direction of propagation, then if we start with these two polarizations, then under this rotation, we'll sort of fold one polarization into the other. And this factor of two here is why sometimes we refer to gravitational waves as spin two, or gravitons as spin two particles, because of how they transform under rotations. Okay, so. So basically you can, there's sort of two polarizations, so you can encode that in one complex number. Yeah, and then when you do it that way, it has this nice, you can write the transform in this nice way. Yeah, so next I want to talk about the generation of gravitational waves. We're going to stick to sort of the weak field regime. We can do the computations. So to generate gravitational waves, we'll need sources. So we'll not be able to assume that our stress energy tensor is zero of matter around. And therefore, we won't be able to impose the transverse traceless, the TT gauge, in the source zone. However, we still have this equation that we wrote down yesterday. The linearized Einstein equation in this harmonic gauge. And remember, this is the trace reversed metric perturbation. So if we want to solve this, the wave equation, similar to probably what's done in your previous physics classes, we can use a Green's function approach. So we'll introduce the Green's function, big G. And when you take the box of that, you get just a delta function. So this is the four-dimensional delta function over space and time. And for the wave function, this is just given by the following. Okay, and so here I've divided up the four coordinate into the spatial components and the time components. And now this is just a delta function sort of along the light cone. And this is going to be a step function. So it's going to give me 1 when this is less than 0, and 0 otherwise. So this gives you the so-called retarded solution, because it's only non-zero in the past. And then we can use the Green's function and integrate over our actual sources given by the stress energy tensor to derive a general solution.
X bar is the source,
and X is the
I'm trying to you. I don't know. You have transition with apparatus.
Yeah. So I mean, basically, we're gonna maybe be clearer when we write down this way. But yeah, basically, we're gonna integrate this over the whole source, right?
Okay.
So this is basically the solution that, so the x dependence here is the one that you'll take the derivatives with respect to here, and then this x bar is the delta function, right?
Mm-hmm. So x bar is where the gravitational wave is getting to?
Yeah, so maybe I'll write down this, but basically the x bar is going to be the point at the source that we're adding up the contribution to,
mm-hmm. Okay.
To find the gravitational wave at x. Yeah, so we're integrating over x bar here to find the contribution at x. And then we can rewrite this using our expression for the the Green's function comes the following. Yeah, so here this is supposed to note the time and the spatial component that you're looking at the stress energy tensor at. And so you can see we are basically use this this step function here to restrict to basically this time along the past light cone. So for convenience, we'll call this TR. So, you know, if you're at some time T, you're looking at some point X. Then you want to perform this integral that's along this past light cone, and this TR is this is TR, just given by that expression. Or this would be X bar. OK, so we're going to try to simplify this integral sum by going to Fourier space. So Fourier transform of HAB just in time. And then we'll plug in that expression there. Integral over the retarded time and space. Okay, and then we can use this to Fourier transform the stress energy tensor itself, doing this integral over the retarded time. So this is the Fourier transform of the stress energy tensor. Yeah, and so now we're going to note that, you know, since we're using the harmonic coordinates or equivalent the Lorentz gauge, and in Fourier space, we can actually write this Lorentz condition as that. So that's, this is just, there's I here. So that's just the, you get, when you take the time derivative, you get this factor here and then spatial derivative there. We really only need to compute the spatial components, and we can get the time component for free that way. So to further simplify this, we're going to need to make some additional assumptions. What we're going to assume is that we have some source zone here where we have
Sorry, is
some.
this H tilde or H tilde bar?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is it fun?
It's just the Fourier transform of H bar.
No, H bar is not a Fourier transform. Tilde is the Fourier transform.
Yeah, it's the Fourier transform of H bar.
Yeah, no, I said, is it H bar? Is it, it's both. Why is it also H? Because H.
Sorry, it's both bar and tilde, that's what I meant.
Oh,
Oh,
right. Okay.
yeah, sorry. Thanks. So we're going to assume we have some source zone, we have some matter. And if we look at sort of the size of that source zone, so that's going to produce some gravitational waves with characteristic length scale lambda. And then we're going to observe it some far away distance r in the wave zone. And basically, we're going to assume is that we have a hierarchy of scales here that we can use to simplify our problem. So first, we're going to assume that r is much greater than this characteristic size of the gravitational wave, which is the same as 1 over its frequency. So that's just the wave zone approximation. So, I mean, that's just a sensible thing to assume if we're actually assuming we're a distance observer and we can sort of unambiguously define gravitational waves. But then the second assumption is sort of a restrictive assumption. We're going to assume that our source size is small compared to the gravitational wavelength.
Sorry, why are we not using traceless transverse gauge? Is there a
Yeah,
four
because
number four degrees of freedom here?
we can't impose that when we have a non-zero stress energy tensor.
Yeah, but an infinity. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're talking about the yeah, here we're interested in the generation of the sources. So we want to have some metric perturbations we generate in this non-vacuum region, and then calculate how the Yeah, so you can, once they propagate to the wave zone, then you can transform to transverse traceless gauge. Yeah, so we're also assuming that our source region is small compared to the length scale of the gravitational waves. So this is true, for example, for compact objects that are moving non-relativistically. Or compact sources in general. However, we'll maybe in a little bit give an example of a situation that's non-relativistic but still doesn't satisfy this condition. So anyway, using this approximation, we can, when trying to evaluate this integral, basically approximate this is just with r, where r is the distance to the source, and r again here. And we can just pull that out of the integral that we're doing. So we're going to try to calculate the remaining parts of the integral, and we're going to use two tricks. One is conservation of stress energy, and the other is this reverse integration by parts.
Sorry, can I ask a question before?
Yeah.
So in the Fourier transform part, for the T, you are taking the Fourier, considering the TR, right? And then, sorry, I can't get it there. So you're integrating on TR, and then Y again, we have TR minus X prime?
Zero omega. This one?
Yes.
Right, because like basically, when we're gonna, yeah, so we started here, right? And this is TR, right? So we're evaluating TAB at TR, right? And so we can just change from our this time coordinate to TR, right? And that's, so we have integral over all time, and then we can change that time coordinate to this TR time coordinate, right?
It can be a plus. Plus the absolute value.
Yeah, in the exponent, I think it should be TR plus X minus X. So if we are changing from T to TR, then why we are integrating on T? Mm-hmm.
Now in the exponent, you subtract X minus X bar twice.
The exponent.
E to the power of I omega T.
Right.
We change from T to TR, so based on that, T is equal to TR plus XI minus XI bar.
Right. Yeah, so sorry, you're saying if I'm...
So yeah, that's not correct, because either this is not correct or that.
Oh yeah, so yeah, I guess I'm missing a minus sign, right?
Yeah.
Should be TR plus XI minus XI bar.
And you use plus in the other line.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Good. Thanks. So we can pull off these two parts here using that. We just want to do this integral over space of the Fourier transform of TAB. And we're just interested in the spatial components, like I said there, to begin with. So we can rewrite this using reverse integration by parts as the following. It's just reverse integration by parts. We take the derivative here. We'll get this term and then this term. So this term is, can anyone tell me, if we just integrate this over all space, is what?
Zero.
Zero, because it's a total derivative. And then this term, or sorry. That's what I want. Integration by parts. And so then this term, we can evaluate just using the conservation of stress energy. So in Fourier space, so that's these are the spatial derivatives. So it's going to equal to the time derivative. And so if we just have this term, and then we can symmetrize it, get the following. And then we're basically going to do the same trick again. Again, integrate by parts, or reverse integrate by parts. Okay, and then again, total derivative, and then can use conservation of stress energy. Get another factor of omega, I omega. And we're going to call this tensor here our quadrupole moment tensor, or its Fourier transform, rather. So if we use this and combine it with the rest of our expression for H, then we have the following.
Step function, you said x bar 0 is bigger than x 0. So if x bar is the observer, it means the retarded solution. So basically, you're integrating over the waves that have gone to the observer. So, and if you want to integrate over the source, you have to integrate over x, not x bar, right?
No, so x bar is, so missing maybe one there. But yeah, it should be integral over x bar.
Now, more confusing. Actually,
I think maybe it's just mistaken definition of theta function, because it should be one when the argument is greater than zero.
So the theta function is x bar zero minus x zero is less than zero?
I mean, it's not zero usually when argument is greater than zero.
Yeah, I'm saying so. Okay, so that's bigger than zero.
I think it should be.
Okay. No, because the way that you define your step function, that x zero minus x bar zero is less than zero, it's one. That means that x bar, because this is a retarded solution, x bar 0 should be the observer. Because for the retarded, x bar 0 should be bigger than x 0 is if x bar 0 is the observer.
Yes.
Yeah. The bar was the source, I guess, right?
Yeah,
so maybe everything has to be the
same. Yeah, the function, it should be greater and not less.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like
yes, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, so we want to integrate over past time, the source, the past times of the source. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, but I think everything else should be right. So we want to do this integral over x bars, because that's basically the coordinate that tracks up all the points in the source zone that will add up to something in the wave zone. Okay, so when we plug in this combined with that express from relating h to this, and then use this approximation. We arrive at this expression, and then we can actually go back to real space and invert the Fourier transform, and basically this omega squared will correspond to two time derivatives. And there, that's our approximation for the retarded time. Okay, so we have some time-varying energy density. Sort of the leading contribution is this coming from the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment, which we defined here.
So what is minus?
So it's we're evaluating this at this look back time t minus r. Yeah, so it's just this thing, and then we're making this approximation. So we can just since xi is much bigger than that, we just approximate it as r. Yeah, so one question you might have, so one question we can ask is why don't lower order moments of the stress energy tensor contribute to gravitational waves? So we can basically consider lower order. So this is the quadrupole moment. But at lower order, we just have a monopole contribution. So the monopole contribution would just be basically the amount of matter within the source zone. So why don't we get radiation from just varying the sort of monopole moment of the stress energy?
It's mass conservation, right? I mean,
yeah, I guess. Well, one, mass conservation, all we can do is take some matter and then move it about, but also, we have Birkhoff's theorem that guarantees that in spherical symmetry, if we just have something that's completely spherically symmetric, then that won't produce gravitation waves because it'll always be Schwarzschild at sufficiently large distances. So then after the monopole, we could consider dipole moment.
Sorry, can you repeat the last statement that you mentioned, the Poisson-Birkhoff theorem?
Yeah, so if we just had some spherical distribution of mass that was moving spherically, that would correspond to some changing monopole, at least within some region, right? But that wouldn't contribute any gravitational waves because by Birkhoff's theorem, if it's spherically symmetric, then outside it should just be Schwarzschild. Yeah, so we can also consider a dipole moment. Of the matter distribution. So in electromagnetism, if we have a time-varying dipole, then we get radiation. So why don't we get that in gravity or in general relativity?
So it's L, right?
Hmm?
It's angular momentum, and it's conserved.
Or linear momentum, right? Or it'd be linear momentum,
I'm
right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, linear momentum. And in EM, because it's vector, right? Is it because of that, that we don't have P conservation there?
Anybody else want to jump in? So in electromagnetism, we have positive charges and negative charges, right? Right, but what about in gravity?
Can I, you said, yeah. Because of Kirchhoff's theorem for the first one, the monopole, and in large enough distances, you get to Schwarzschild metric, so it can't be a gravitational wave propagation, if I understood you correctly. But
I'm just saying, if you have a, you know, say that you just take like a spherically symmetric collapse or something, right? Then you'll have a time changing monopole within some region,
right?
But you won't have gravitational waves from that by Birkhoff's theorem.
Yeah, but you said, why don't we have, because by Birkhoff's theorem, when you go to the infinity, because you have one solution, it would be Schwarzschild solution.
Yeah.
But you're saying at infinity, what if you're close enough? Right outside? Ah, okay.
Yeah, like in, basically once, if it was outside in the matter region, you have
right,
Schwarzschild,
right?
Yeah, so... So basically, in spherical symmetry, they're not going to be any gravitational waves. So if you have like some spherically symmetric collapse or some spherically symmetric explosion, you can sort of change the amount of mass within the source zone, but it's not going to produce gravitational waves. So sort of that alone is not enough.
Sorry, you talked about conservation? I didn't quite follow. You said because mass is also conserved? Did you talk about that right now? What did you say?
Yeah, I said if you imagine the scenario where I have spherically symmetric collapse, so some, you know, stars and planets collapsing, or some explosion, so you have some explosion of matter within some, it starts in some region, then explodes out and moves outward. Neither of those, if they're spherically symmetric, even though you can sort of change the amount of matter within the source zone, neither of those would produce gravitational waves. Because they're spherically symmetric.
But if they're not symmetric, so if you have a process that is not spherically symmetric, you would have gravitational waves that cause the monopoles?
And it's not monopole.
Well, I'm saying, therefore, a monopole is not enough. So you actually need a time-varying quadrupole.
Let's say you had some sort of weird mechanism in which the collapse was not spherically symmetric.
Yeah, so if you have asymmetric collapse, that can produce gravitational waves. But we're basically arguing that you need these higher order moments to produce gravitational waves. That if the, you know, in the case that the higher order moments are zero and just have the lower order ones, they don't on their own produce gravitational waves.
But the
monopole
would be the...
Yeah, so for... electromagnetism, we have, you know, opposite charges, right? So we can have, you know, positive and minus charges that are, for example, oscillating back and forth. But for gravity, we just have positive mass, right? And we can sort of always go to a center of mass frame where this dipole contribution would vanish, as you alluded to.
So can you also repeat that this relation to the linear momentum?
Right, well,
first derivative is the momentum,
yeah.
Then the second derivative if this is the first derivative of the momentum. And if the momentum is conserved, then the derivative of momentum is zero.
Right. I mean, in theory, gravitational waves can carry linear momentum, right? So, I mean, that's possible. But yeah, but we can go to a. I mean, if we just look at the momentum of the source, we can go to the center mass frame and make this one vanish, right? Yeah. And so then after monopole dipole, then we're at the quadrupole, and that's where we get gravitational wave contribution.
Now I got companies. So from that, I thought, okay, the dipole moment, if it's zero, it means that the linear momentum is conserved. But we can have these kicks from the gravitational waves. So if I'm not sure if I'm saying it correctly. If you have a binary and then in the end, gravitational wave, the remnant would go to the other side. So it means then that the linear momentum is not conserved.
Yeah, I mean, so gravitational waves can carry away energy, they can carry away angular momentum, they can carry away linear momentum as well.
So then it means that we can have dipole radiation?
No, I mean, that's not the same. The same thing, right? I mean, so whatever, conservation of momentum would just say, like, if the gravitational waves are carrying off some linear momentum, then the source has to be losing that. Like here, I'm just arguing that if we're looking at some, non-relativistic source or whatever, we can always go to this center of mass frame where that source, or basically make this vanish, right?
Right.
So for like a binary or something, you could start in the center of mass frame. I could let off some gravitational waves, like that would carry away linear momentum, and then in that original center of mass frame, the remnant would now have a kick. Because the gravitational waves carried away some momentum.
The momentum within the source by itself, it's still conserved. So it's better maybe if I call this one, balanced law, that is.
But so here the argument that the dipole shouldn't produce anything is basically you just have some source that just has a dipole, you can make a transformation to a frame where this vanishes, right? Okay, so yeah, so I just want to quickly return to this question of when we can sort of use this quadrupole formula that we derived. Making this assumption that the source zone is small compared to the gravitational waves. So you'll remember a week or two ago we discussed this super radiant stability where you have a boson cloud that would grow around a black hole. And so actually it turns out those because they're oscillating with some frequency, will actually produce gravitational waves. So we have some black hole, and then we discussed how we could sort of do a non-relativistic approximation where this cloud sits far away from the black hole, and then it kind of looks like a hydrogen atom. So it has some it sits at some characteristic scale, which is analogous to the Bohr radius, which is given by, so recall mu is the mass of this boson, and then alpha is this dimension, is our quote-unquote fine structure constant, which is the combination of the black hole mass and mu. And so we were assuming that we're in the regime where this is much smaller than one, so non-relativistic. And then, so this cloud is going to oscillate at a frequency omega, or which is to leading order just going to be mu, and then it'll produce gravitational waves at twice that frequency, basically because the stress energy tensor is quadratic in the field. So can anyone tell me why the quadrupole formula doesn't apply to this source, even though it's weak field and non-relativistic in our approximation? Yeah, so the size of the system is going to be given by this. And then the wavelength of the gravitational waves is going to be given by 1 over this, which is going to be the order of 1 over mu. And so since we have this extra factor of alpha, which is much smaller than 1, the size of the cloud will be much bigger than the gravitational waves. So basically, you can think of the reason this approximation breaks down is because all the different parts of the cloud are sort of incoherently producing gravitational waves. Because they're spread out over sort of larger than a wavelength, their individual contributions can sort of, both constructively and destructively add up. And so for that reason, this quadrupole approximation doesn't work.
Sorry, where did you use when the R source is much less than the wavelength of the gravitational waves? But where did you use that approximation? In this approximation, I assume that you just use the first one in this term here, e to the power of I omega R over R. Use the fact that R is way bigger than 1 over omega, I suppose.
Yeah, we basically use that when we're we use that up here too, because basically if we're when we want to do this integral, we basically want to just add up all the different contributions of the gravitational waves here. And we can just sort of coherently add them up if we make this approximation. But if they, if basically the gravitational waves you can imagine you have some source here, and then it's propagating, and then by the time it adds up with this other source here, it's out of phase.
Right.
And then in terms of this integral, those were correspond to things canceling out.
Kind of basically has both. Because if you put back this back into the integral without an extra phase, you're basically assuming, okay.
Yep.
So can you please talk more about what is in the cloud? The entire cloud is oscillating, or there are particles there?
You can get these. So basically, these are just solutions to the massive Klein coordinate equation. If you want to sort of take the particle perspective, they're sort of a coherent excitation of a large, exponentially large number of bosons that are all sort of in phase. But because the super radiance exponential growth basically makes them all in phase, so it's kind of like maybe sort of analogous to the photons in a laser or something, because they're all coherent. You can just treat them as like the classical fields, And so here, yeah, you can just treat it using the classical fields because it's, you know, very high occupation number for this one state.
From this system, we can get scalar radiation as well, right?
This doesn't produce any scalar radiation, basically, because, or at least at this order, because basically all the bosons are bound to the system, right? So they're gravitationally bound. That's why they sit there. So you need some sort of nonlinear interaction to produce scalar radiation. Yeah. So this case. The quadrupole formula doesn't apply. But sort of the, you know, the canonical example of gravitational waves that we think of is, you know, where we have, say, you know, two objects, stars or black holes or something, they're separated by some distance, and they're, you know, orbiting around each other. So in this case, as long as they're moving non-relativistically, so we can calculate what the gravitational wave frequency is going to be. And it's going to be twice the orbital frequency, or 4 pi over the period of this orbit. And then if they're moving non-relativistically, we can just approximate that using Kepler's law. And so then we have basically, when we're comparing the wavelength to the wavelength of the gravitation waves compared to the size of our source region, which would be sort of, you know, twice this distance, we're sort of suppressed by this factor that as long as the masses are as long as the gravitational potential is weak and they're moving non-relativistically, this will be much less than one. So then we can use the quadrupole formula until you know, these objects are getting close and start moving close to the speed of light. All right. Any questions about that?
Sorry, what was it? Two times the orbital frequency? You should probably know this.
Yeah, you can just kind of think like when they switch places, that's one period, right? So that's why as far as the gravitational waves are concerned. So the gravitational waves will go through sort of two cycles when the orbit goes through one cycle, because they'll sort of switch places twice.
Oh, yeah, okay.
All right, so in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to get started in talking about energy and angular momentum in gravitational waves. So in order to calculate the energy and angular momentum that are carried away in gravitational waves, what we want to do is sort of write down an effective stress energy tensor for the gravitational waves. So this is sort of going to be by necessity, a gauge dependent quantity, basically because you can't localize gravitational wave energy to sort of more to a distance smaller than the wavelength of the gravitational waves, because you can think of, you know, you could always in some local region go to some, you know, make a coordinate transformation such that your metric is locally flat, such that around that point the Christoffel symbols vanish, and then you only sort of you know, feel the curvature of spacetime once you sort of move sort of length scales of the curvature length away from your original point. So in that sense, you can't, in a gauge invariant way, localize the gravitational wave energy. But we'll sort of get around that by averaging things sort of over a wavelength of the gravitational waves and come up with a effective stress energy tensor that way and use it to calculate the gravitational wave energy and angular momentum. So the idea is to expand the Einstein field equations to second order. So we have our metric. We're saying it's we're in the weak field, so the zeroth order is just flat space. Then we're adding our first order perturbation, which we're calling the gravitational waves. And then we have a second order correction. And then if we sort of plug that into the Einstein equations, we can expand the Ricci tensor. So we'll have the contribution from the zeroth order part. And that'll just be zero because it's flat space. Then we'll have a contribution for this first order part and a second order part. And so at first order, the Einstein equations, you know, assuming no sources, just say that so by this I mean the Einstein tensor just calculated to first order as using this first order metric function. Should just be zero. But then at second order, we're going to have two contributions. So we're going to have one contribution, which will be the first order Einstein tensor evaluated at the second order metric piece. And then we'll have an additional contribution, which will be the Einstein tensor expanded to second order, then evaluated on the first order metric tensor. And so the combination of the two should be zero to allow our equations to be satisfied to second order. So this part here is going to be linear and metric perturbations, and this one here will be quadratic. And the idea basically is that we're going to, you know, move one of these to the right-hand side and call it our effective stress energy tensor. So this is the definition of this lowercase TAB, which is going to be the effective stress energy tensor of our gravitational waves. and just sort of check that this is kind of a sensible thing. You know, first we can note that TAB will be symmetric just by this definition, because the Einstein tensor is symmetric. We can note that it's going to be conserved at the correct order in linear perturbation theory. Can anyone tell me why it's going to be conserved? Bianchi identity. And it's going to be basically a quadratic function of our linear metric perturbation. So, you know, in the same way that, for example, the stress energy tensor of a scalar field is quadratic in the field. But just to note again, you know, this is not gauge invariant. And then we're going to get around this by essentially averaging over the gravitational wavelength. Okay, so maybe I'm going to go ahead and write down the equations we're going to. Maybe it's not a good idea. Okay, I think I'll just stop here for now, and ask quickly if you have any questions, and we'll continue that next time.
You said it's not gauge invariant because we haven't. Why can't we make it gauge invariant?
Basically, sort of the physical intuition is, say you want to say right exactly at this point in space and time, there's like this and much energy from the gravitational waves. I can say, okay, let me make a coordinate transformation to some new set of coordinates where at that point you have flat space, and then the first derivatives of the metric actually vanish, right? So the Christoffel symbols at that point vanish, right?
So you're averaging over the gravitational wave length? What is that?
So in some sense, you can make things locally flat, but you can't make them flat everywhere, right? By a coordinate transformation, basically, go on the curvature length scale, you have to feel the curvature, because that's like encoded in the Riemann tensor. So you sort of have to say, if I'm averaging around a neighborhood at this point.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let me stop there and see you for the last class on Thursday.